Alrighty.
Let's do this.
Let's do this. Cubecast podcast. I'm Waffo, and joined with me is Brandon. Oh, sorry, Ronza and Mitch. We promised you a great season, but we only pretend to know what we're doing.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious.
Today is February 28th, oh, man. 2016.
Today we're speaking with Phil Yu, who's a ZZ pioneer, one-handed extraordinaire, founder of the Cubicle.us, and a small kitten. Additionally, we're going to talk about the plans for Cubecast, the changes that we've implemented since, you know, October, when we had our last episode.
Okay, so a little bit of housekeeping. What we've recently done is expanded our team so that we have more people helping us out creating the Cubecast. One thing that we're going to try to do is create a new website that looks really nice and pretty. We have a pretty talented person working on that right now. And just overall, our team is a lot bigger, so collecting data and doing the podcast is going to be distributed more evenly, so it's going to be easier for us to make the episodes. And hopefully you guys should enjoy it more. We're going to have a separate team kind of making an episode called The Halfcast just about the records and the news. But for this episode, we're going to have the records and the news in it. The Halfcast is not going to start until the next episode, so just wait for that. And iTunes, do we have any news on iTunes?
Yeah, we're getting iTunes full integration. We have our web development person, Statue Koric, on that, and he's working with that. I'm not sure what all the details are, but he says he has it covered, so this should be also out on iTunes. And if you're listening to this on iTunes, hello.
It worked!
Welcome to the Cubecast podcast.
It worked. It worked, and we're okay, and it's great. So, yeah. Let's move on to, I guess, records now of... Oh, Mitch, stop dying.
God.
Mitch, can you not die this episode? We kind of need you for the rest of it, you know?
I'll try.
No, Mitch, there is no try. There is only not dying.
Okay.
Okay, Mitch? So, as Mitch said, Halfcast will be doing all of the records, but because there is no Halfcast, we're going to go ahead and do the world records for the day. If you want a list of all of the records, including Continental Records, view the show notes, scroll down, and then follow the link. We've compiled everything there for you.
Alright, so we're going to start these records off with the China Championship 2015 on October 2nd, 2015. I don't remember if we actually covered these. I actually didn't go back to check, not going to lie. But I'm going to go over them anyway, because there's four of them. First one, 3x3 Blindfolded World Record by Kai Jun Lin of China, with a single of 21.05. And then the other three records, world records set at the competition, were by Felix Zemdegs of Australia, a 4x4 single world record of 21.54, 5x5 world record single of 47.25, and 5x5 world record average of 50.23. Dang.
Dang. So he solves 5x5 faster than I can 4x4?
And... Yeah, he solves it faster than I, like, in... almost half the time that I can do 4x4.
Great. Awesome. We're so good at cubing. Isn't that right, Mitch?
God.
All right. So the next record we have is 3x3 Fewest Moves, world record by Tim Wong, tied with who else?
No, he broke the record first.
Oh, he broke the record first. That's right. Oh, well. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Tim. I messed up. You got world record at 19 at Irvine Fall 2015. Good job. Congratulations.
Waffle, what are you dosing?
It's Irvine, not Irvin.
Whatever, man.
I like
Irvine.
How I'm like doing the pronunciation on that one.
Okay.
Speaking of pronunciation, the next competition, Mitch?
You purposely did this, I swear. So this is a competition that's in Poland. It happened 10/17/2015. You can go check the name of this competition, but the world record that was set at this competition was by Jonathan Klosko with a Scoob single of 1.10. So that's 2x2. Scoob is getting as fast as 2x2.
Okay, then a week later, at Lexington Fall 2015, Drew Brads set a couple of Pyraminx World Records. First one with a 1.32 single and 2.52 average. So Pyraminx and Scoob are still very ridiculously close. But for him to get a mid-2 average...
It was just a matter of time.
Like, Scoob average... I thought. I mean, Scoob average is what, like 2.8, 2.9? I don't remember. I don't remember for sure. But that's ridiculous.
So the next competition is Melbourne Cube Days 2015 in Australia. We have a few oh, never mind. Felix Zemdegs breaking 5x5 world record single with 46.97, and then breaking 5x5 world record average with a 50.15. Oh, boy. And he also got 6x6 world record average at 1 minute 43.8 seconds. And 7x7 world record average at 2 minutes 30.1 seconds.
Too fast. Okay, the big record that happened recently. The big one.
The big one?
The very big one.
The one that's, like, huge?
The one that was big, yes. Was
wink, nudge.
Yeah, so it happened at River Hill Fall 2015. 3x3 world record single set by Lucas Etter at a time of 4.90. This was the first sub-5 single. And he ninja'd Keaton, like, a couple hours after.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that day in cubing, because that was a lot. All right, so the next competition we have is MPEI Open 2015, and Roman Strakov of Russia set a 5x5 blindfolded world record of 5 minutes, 4.8 seconds. How? How?
How?
I don't get it.
Because he's good. So our next competition is Santa Claus Cube Race 2015. What an interesting name for a competition. World record cube average by Jonathan Klosko from Poland. Averages 2.95 seconds.
I guess that answers my question about what Scoob average was. I can't even read.
Okay, next world record was the fewest moves 3x3 single tie by Marcel Peters at Cubalonia 2016 in Germany. He tied Tim Wong's 19. That's about it.
Yeah. And last but not least, we have Square One world record average by Brandon Lin of USA at Slow and Steady Winter 2016. I for one was very glad to see him get the world record. I know that he was like, I don't want to say that he was going for it, but dude definitely deserves it, like 100%.
Going for world record.
the year of the Square One, as a statue put it.
Yeah, statue like called 2016 as the year of the Square One. So let's see if that's actually correct.
If it's correct, I'm gonna buy him a drink. Just saying.
Okay, that sounds good.
The end of the year. If there's 5 more Square One records, I owe you a drink, statue.
And so that concludes the record section. So next up, we're gonna bring in our guest, Phil Yu. Welcome, Phil.
Hey everyone, this is Phil, and this is how I normally start my YouTube videos. But I have never made a YouTube video this year so far, so I'm glad to be producing more content this time.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. So, Phil, a little bit of background on you. You're a pioneer of the ZZ method. You are an OH extraordinaire, one of the founders of the Cubicle.us, and a small kitten.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty good. Except, I don't know, OH is getting really difficult right now. Just people are getting so unbelievably fast.
So you're not denying that you're a small kitten?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, great.
All right. Oh, wait, what do you average for one hand?
That's a very good question. it's really random. I haven't practiced very seriously in a while, so it can be anything from 13 to 15.
Okay.
Yeah. Usually on the other end when I'm competing too.
All right. Okay. So we have some questions for you from our wonderful listeners and from some of the hosts and people at the CubeCast. So from us, Waffo asks, well, you should probably ask it, Waffo, because you're here.
Yeah, because I'm here, right? That would make sense. That we're so good at the show. Okay, anyways, my first question has to deal kind of like ZZ. Like, what was it that kept you from switching to, say, other methods? Like, other popular methods. Like, what about ZZ kept you with it?
Okay, well, it wasn't so much things about ZZ, but I guess things about other methods. So what I did was I switched from CFOP to ZZ, and I'm guessing, like, it's pointless to switch back because that just makes everything I did with ZZ useless. So I didn't switch back to CFOP. I really didn't understand how Rue worked, so I never went to that, and I never felt that Petrus was that strong of a method for speed solving, so I guess kind of by process of elimination, I just stuck with ZZ because every other choice didn't really make sense to me.
Okay, okay. Really interesting. So just nothing made sense.
Well, that and I get free OLL, and that was actually a motivating factor to switch to ZZ. I was just simply too lazy to do OLL.
Hey!
It's a ridiculous thing thinking back now because I'm learning COLL and CLS and all sorts of other things that just ends up totally more than OLL, so it wasn't... I don't think I did myself a favor if the point was to
lower.
Avoid learning ALX.
You and me both. Exact same reason why I chose Rue. Avoid ALX.
That's exactly how I feel about, like, doing the edge control stuff. Like, there were a couple... There are only a few OLLs that I don't know, but I went so far out of my way to just avoid doing OLL altogether by learning so many more ALGs than if I just, you know, finished OLL.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I have a couple questions for you. What major challenges did you and James have in trying to start your own business, and what challenges came along the way as your business expanded?
Okay, well, challenges... aside from the typical business challenges, one thing was breaking into the market. It's always a challenge because starting a business is a very front-loaded effort, which basically it boils down to you're front-loading a lot of money into starting this thing. Not only money, but resources and time. And you're kind of investing emotionally into this thing as well. And you won't see results for a long time before your business kind of pays for itself. And so the first challenge we had was just to convince ourselves that it was a good thing to do. And that's especially hard when there are other established businesses in the industry already, because you have to compete with them when you're first starting out. And when you're the little guy, sometimes things can be tough. But as we've grown the business, we got past those, and now our biggest challenge currently is space. We had some space problems recently, which caused some processing to be slow. So what we're doing is we're looking for a new, bigger, cooler space to accommodate our business and, have a new platform to ship orders and serve customers, which it's going pretty well. We are currently scouting out a place, and it's really nice, so I'm happy about that, and hopefully we can move there soon and kind of pass this challenge also.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's good to hear that business is
booming.
doing so well that space is one of your issues. It's not great that space is your issue, but it's a better issue than having too much space, I suppose.
Yeah, well, too much space, I guess, like, if you project that you're growing, you can eventually grow into it.
Yeah.
Which is, it's like, yeah, you're paying for space that you're not using, but it's not nearly as bad as, like, not having enough space, and then everyone's cramped, and the work environment is really stuffy. So,
yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, we're glad we're, like, kind of past that.
So you spoke about kind of breaking into the market. When you guys first started, you guys had a lot of custom cubes, like custom modded cubes. Was that, like, kind of, I would say, part of your plan to try to provide something more original into the marketplace?
Okay, yeah, well, this is a business strategy that a lot of people use. It's not only a way to provide unique and interesting products to people, but it's also a way to jumpstart the business without using money. So essentially, when you start, you're buying inventory and supplies and equipment and computers and all sorts of other things to support your business, but all of that takes money. Whereas if you use your know-how and your expertise and your time to service cubes, that's not exactly money. And so that's an investment in time that we decided would be a cool thing to do to both provide a cool service to people and also to increase our earnings without having to spend money on it.
Cool stuff, cool stuff. I just want to let you know I'm still using a Xantry Silk from way back when.
What?
Oh, yeah. Man.
If cubing ever had museums.
Yeah, it would be there. It would be there. It's been reliable. I'm not going to lie. I still use it.
It'll be there. Yeah. The whole modding cubes thing has been so weird. It was really interesting because like cubes had to be modded in one way or another back then, whether it's, you know, hybrid pieces and sanding them or whatnot. And now I think designers are trying their best to design something that doesn't need to be tinkered with so much.
Mitch, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Sorry. I have a couple questions. How did the original idea of running a cube store happen? Like, was in the beginning, was it just you and James, and you decided, or he decided, that you wanted to run a cube company together?
Okay, so how this all went down was, I guess I was in college, and we cubed in class, you know, like how typical college students do. And I met James in class, and he was like cubing. and so we became good friends, and we were both business students, and he was really good with computers, and I knew the cubing market pretty well, and so you know, it came to me that, you know, maybe we should do something about our interest in business and our interest in cubing. And so I proposed to him, why not start a cube store? And so we did that while we were still in college, and pretty much the things that we were brainstorming about and contemplating back then, it's so different from what it is now. It's like there's no way we could have guessed it would have turned out to be what it's now currently, but it was my idea to start the store, and then James built our, you know, the tech part of our company on his cool computer.
Yeah, awesome. That's so you said you could never have expected to see the market be as it is today.
I mean, it's my full-time job now, and it's the full-time job of many, many people, and that's a thing that I never actually considered when I was in college.
All right, so we have some questions from our listeners. Sparsh Ilawadi, do you remember who your first customer was?
I do not, but I can probably find out. hold on, I'm trying to find out.
Okay, cool, okay.
I won't like disclose their name or anything, but I can tell you where the order originated from.
Oh yeah.
Okay, it went to Indianapolis.
Oh.
And it was a white Xantry.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
When was that, like 2013 or something?
2011.
Oh wow, I was way off.
It was late 2011.
You guys have been around. Jeez.
Yeah, I guess, like, I don't know. We're one of the newer stores.
But still.
But we're kind of not new. So, yeah, our identity's been changing quite a bit.
Okay, so Michael Edmonds has a really, I would say, generic question. Which is,
sure.
Basically, if you had to pick two events to remove, what are they and why?
Okay, so I'm required to pick two events and remove them, right?
Yes, not just one.
I have
to pick
two. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, this is going to make me sound like a total jerk, but I guess the safe answer would be feet, right?
That's a pretty safe answer.
I won't get attacked or anything if I say that. I guess the reason is the community seems to have reservations about it. So, you know, it would be consistent with a lot of other people's feelings. And as for the other one, because guys had to pick two, it would probably be a big cube or big blind.
Okay.
Because it would be, like, it's... I don't have any background in big cubes, but... I guess the reason for not having bigger cubes than the ones we have is because it's kind of duplicative, right? Like, it doesn't take an entirely new skill set to do a larger cube, so it would be one of the big cube events.
Hmm, interesting.
Okay.
And how about if you had to add two events?
If I had to add two events... okay. So this is the thing. I've, like, never proposed events before.
Ooh.
But I think mirror blocks are very interesting.
Mirror blocks. Who's that one guy who's, like, really, really good at mirror blocks?
Sebastian Hafner?
Yeah.
The German guy, right? He's ridiculous.
Yeah. I would love, like, mirror blocks... Yeah. Wow,
Yeah, because a lot of the events that people think are really cool, they're actually cool, but like they have administration problems, like Team Blend.
Yeah, exactly.
Like as cool as it is, it's like really hard to administer the event in a fair way, and so yeah, I would have actually really liked Team Blind as well, but it's like really difficult to do.
And then for your second event?
Perhaps some form of relay.
Ooh.
But,
relay.
I don't know. It's a pretty generic thing, but a relay would be pretty cool because it would exercise, I guess, anticipation because you can't really... inspect enough for, you know, a number of cubes beyond what you get for 15 seconds.
Yeah.
So perhaps a relay would be interesting. But, I mean, aside from the anticipation factor, it doesn't really exercise any unique skills either. Yeah, I guess, long story short, I think our event list is pretty well-rounded.
All right.
It's, like, really hard to pick... subtractions and additions.
Yeah, the tough part with relays that I've been thinking about is just keeping track of that many cubes for people with cube covers, and it just seems almost like a logistical nightmare.
Well, I mean, I'd assume there wouldn't be too big a problem if you just had all the cubes uncovered, right?
Had all of them uncovered?
Yeah.
You just get like a giant sheet of paper.
Oh, I'm thinking or about, like, just... the running process. Like, the scrambling and running process. Of course, runners aren't explicit... they're not an explicit role in the regulations, but, like... I would think that it would be difficult on... At least it's for some relays more than others, especially with just number of cubes, keeping all the competitors' cubes together.
Yeah, well, they have multi-blind boxes, but I guess relays would be really low barrier to entry, because if you can solve a 2x2, a 3x3, and a 4x4, you can do a relay, and it would add a lot of time to a competition. It's not like multi-blind where, like, if you can't do it, you can't do it. So I guess that would be another issue.
Yeah, well, multi-blind still takes a considerable amount of time, but I guess there are a lot more barriers, as you were saying, to entering multi-blind. So it's just less likely to be held. Whereas relays, it'd almost be no question. Oh yeah, could we hold a relay? Absolutely. Is there going to be demand for it? Absolutely. So, all right.
Yeah.
So the next set of questions are from Teddy. What's your favorite movie?
That's a really good question. I don't have one.
I don't
watch movies. I seriously don't. I don't. Okay, I remember the last movie I went to watch, because it was Star Wars, and, like, everyone watches that, almost. But I just, the type of person I am, I just can't stay still for 2 hours and just watch one thing. Like, I prefer to be distracted by things around me, and obviously, when you do that in a theater or something, people complain. So,
just a little bit.
I haven't. I'm not like super attracted to movies, so I really don't have a favorite that I like go back to.
Guess I can't go on a date with Phil now.
Yeah, that's too bad. Movie, pizza.
Hey, there are plenty of other date activities.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
All right, and the next question from Teddy is to say the word water in a British accent.
Oh, damn it. I don't know how to do that. Water? I don't know.
All right. Well, there's that. Thank
That's
you.
Not a question.
Thank you.
That's not a question, yes.
It's not a question. Yeah. I suppose he meant to say... would you mind saying water in the British accent, or will you please say water in the British accent?
Oh, okay,
the
then
answer would have been
then
no.
I can say no.
The answer would have been no.
Well, yes, I mind, and no, I won't do that.
All right, next question from Vilius Ribinskus. Is Chris going to get another note from Cubicle?
I mean, that's a really broad answer. Like, is he ever going to get a note? Yes. I don't know when. But, you know, we send him friendly notes every now and then.
Aw.
Because we're friends.
Aw, that's so cute. So, next set of questions is from Tiffany Chan. But, well, the first question is actually something we've already talked about, which is why you went to look at ZZ and why you keep using it. But the next question is actually pretty interesting because I believe we started around the same time in cubing. When did you start?
I started April 2008.
Yeah, so we're kind of around the same.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the cubing community has evolved from when you first started?
The community?
Yeah, just the community as a whole.
Okay. That's an interesting question because when you say the community, it kind of, I don't know, it makes me think of one community, but there are a lot of communities. But I guess cubing in general... It has been, I think it's developed very similarly to sports, where, you know, in sports, the equipment's getting better, the athletes are getting more technically developed, and also physically. A lot of sports start off as, like, if you're just really good at the technique, you'll compete very well. But now it's, if you're not technically good and you can't also lift weights like every day and exercise, you're not going to be good. And so I think cubing has really taken that direction. It takes a lot of different types of practice to win a very large competition now. And I feel it's a lot more competitive than when it was back then, where people who started early had a very big advantage compared to people who are new. But now you have to learn a lot of algs, have a very good control of your intuitive tendencies, have a really good control of yourself while you're competing. And so I think it takes the set of abilities and skills it takes for a person to do really well now is completely different from back then. Not to, you know, discredit anybody competing at a high level back then. It's just absolutely insane now that people can get 7 averages.
7 averages and not, like, a big competition. Just, like, little tiny West Coast, East Coast comps.
Yeah. In fact, I went to one yesterday, and there were 8 more. I don't even know how many 8 averages there were.
Yeah, at least the podium was something.
Wait a second. That was the best podium, right?
No, I think 4th best.
That was,
fourth.
I think, the 3rd best,
podium. Yeah.
Or 3rd or 4th. Yeah, it was a pretty ridiculous podium.
For, like, a small-time competition. I mean, competitions are just getting ridiculous in general.
Well, the thing is, like, it really has... Competitions around me really have changed my view of what is considered small-time. It's, like, not a national competition or a big thing in terms of, like, its name or its stature, but it attracts people who compete at that level. And so, like, every competition feels like it's huge.
Yeah. How many competitors approximately were at the competition you were at yesterday?
There were over 100. I know that the limit was 140, but I'm not quite sure how many people actually showed up.
Okay.
It looks like 125.
125.
Did 3x3. Yeah, the 125 people did 3x3.
Yeah, these competitions that are not very big in terms of name and stature, but are attracting people not just people who are world class or at least very highly competitive in general, but attracting just a sheer higher volume of people than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. The East Coast is crazy.
Yeah, over here it was crazy. I went to a competition last week, 160 competitors. It was
wow.
This is the Berkeley one.
Berkeley, yeah, it was absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, I don't know how we can only schedule an hour and a half for 3x3 round one.
Do you have strict cutoffs?
We attempt to have strict cutoffs. Okay. Yeah, the 4x4 cutoffs were changed to 1 minute soft and 1:30 hard. It was a lot. We had to cut rounds and stuff, but.
Oh, man.
It happened. Well, yeah, because there were so many more competitors than were expected. Because I don't know why they still allowed at-door registration, but
oh, that's tricky.
Yeah, but for a significantly higher rate. But people don't mind paying $25 for a cube competition.
Well, I mean, they've shown up, so
exactly. People keep showing up.
Yeah, it's not like you're going to say no.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not like they're going to say no if the price is too high. They're there already, so...
yeah, that's why, I don't know, with the model that Mitch and I have assumed, it's...
Mm-hmm.
You gotta pay online, and, you know, we had to turn away Tyson Mao because of that. Anyway.
Oh, man, no. No. Did he show up and you guys were like, no.
Yeah, that totally actually happened.
Oh, no.
That really happened. He said, hey, guys, where's registration? And we're like,
not here.
It's online, and it closed.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. All right, so the next question Tiffany asked was, do you have a kitten?
No, I don't, but I really want to get a cat. And so when I move into a new place very soon, I'm going to try to find one
off the street.
Because they're good.
Like, I like this one. It has mange or whatever.
Okay, so the next question that Tiffany asked was, what type of lawyer are you, or what is your profession, or... I guess maybe she was trying to ask, what's your specialization?
Oh, okay. My specialization is in IP and entertainment.
Okay.
And so when I went to school, I studied really, I guess, theoretical things about IP, mostly legislation. And so my areas of interest is mostly around copyright. I think it's really interesting in the current environment we live in where people consume media really, really rapidly, and a lot of people don't seem to really understand what copyright is. And so, yeah, part of me got really, I guess, deep into how do we educate people.
Yeah. Was it just American copyright or copyright on an international scale?
Mostly American. The way our laws are written now, it's a bit difficult for a person with no background to really understand it because there are a bunch of rules and then there are a bunch of exceptions and then there are some tests. And without knowing how courts apply a test, you're not going to be able to anticipate any sort of result like fair use.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a really gray area, and you have to look at what past courts did, and that in itself is a job for a lawyer, so that's really tricky. But I just smile when someone uploads an entire season of a TV show and goes, no copyright infringement intended. And, that's not relevant at all.
No.
So, yeah, it's really weird. And then the question's like, how do you educate these people? And how do you teach them what the law is without, you know, being biased? Because I'm sure, half of the people want to teach it's absolutely forbidden to infringe because we have rights. And the other half are like, you know, you should be more free with consuming media because it's entertainment. And so education's a really interesting part, and that's like my main legal interest.
Okay.
I also studied artificial intelligence and like weapons.
Ooh. Note to self, but, Phil's trying to take over the world. One cube at a time.
But yeah, in the sense that people are building weapons to kill each other. And these weapons are becoming more and more autonomous. Like drones, for example, it's an example of a weapon that is very highly automated.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I wrote a bunch of papers on just automation, and the next step would be to have machines that attack targets without human input. So, like, it would identify an enemy and destroy it. And that is a very problematic thing from a legal perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, a follow-up question from Tiffany. It was, why did you decide to go to law school and become a lawyer? Or why are you doing whatever you're doing job-wise? Which is, you know, you said you work full-time for the cubicle.
Oh, okay. So, why... Okay, that's two questions.
Two questions, yeah.
The first, why did I go to school? Yes. It was for a number of reasons. When I was an undergraduate, I did music licensing, and music licensing was pretty legal in nature, and I really liked the whole idea of synchronizing sound to video games and films and commercials and stuff, which is the type of stuff that I did. And so going to law school in part was to learn more about that, because I think that's what I would have become had I not worked at the cubicle. And the other part was to enrich my understanding of a service type industry where your clients are people, and you try to solve their problems. And I think that's really helped me learn more about how to solve people's problems. And the reason I'm working at where I am right now is because I just can't leave cubing. It's such a ridiculously cool thing, and it's such a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to work at a job where you just do cubing things that I don't think anybody would pass up the opportunity if they cube. It's like, I feel like it's a thing that I won't ever get a chance to do again. And so that's why I prefer this occupation over a more conventional one, because I'm fairly confident in the future if I had to switch career paths for any reason, I could still be a lawyer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this whole cubing thing doesn't pan out for me. At least I can go into law. That's all I got out of this.
Yeah, but you can't say the opposite, right? You can't, you know, if I signed up to work at a large company or a law firm or whatever, you know, the chance of, hey, let's just start a cubing company, it becomes less and less realistic as time goes on. So it made sense to do this. It's a pretty cool job.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And then two last questions from Tiffany, which will wrap up the whole question section, is, what is your favorite type of cookie, and do you like pandas?
Okay, so I don't have a favorite type of cookie.
What?
I can't eat cookies. I'm lactose intolerant.
Oh.
There are certain oatmeal raisin cookies that I can't eat without feeling like I'm going to die. So maybe I'll just say that. But I avoid cookies because they just absolutely nuke my stomach.
What about vegan cookies?
That's interesting.
I mean,
I guess
I've had some. They're really good.
Are they? Okay.
Like 9 times out of 10 that I've had vegan cookies, they are phenomenal.
Are they expensive?
Well, I sell them. So
are you trying to sell me cookies?
I mean, I'm not trying to sell you cookies.
Are you sure? Because you seem like you want to sell me cookies.
I am not advocating for you to buy them from me, but I'm advocating for you to at least try them.
So yes.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I didn't actually know they existed. Pandas, yeah, they're fluffy.
Yeah, buddy.
Pandas are awesome.
All right. So I guess that wraps up all of our questions from our listeners and from us. So thank you for that, Phil. Lots of very interesting insight into your personal life of being a small kin. So now we're going to go ahead and take a very short commercial break. And when we get back, we're going to go ahead and tackle some news that has happened in the community in the past how long now?
6 months.
6 months? Okay, yeah, 6 months. All right, so stay tuned for that.
This episode of the CubeCast podcast is brought to you by thecubicle.us. We're so pleased to have Phil on the show. He's been really supportive of our endeavors and has helped guide us in this next season. In fact, we are launching a new website, cubecast.fm, which is being developed and maintained by thecubicle.us. So again, many thanks to them. They offer free shipping to the U.S. and Puerto Rico for orders totaling more than $10, and always have the latest cubes among a wide selection of puzzles. Whether you need a new cube, want to try a different color scheme, buy logo stickers from major cube brands, or get custom logos, or buy lubricant to keep your cubes in top shape, thecubicle.us is the place to go. You can go check them out at thecubicle.us.
And we're back. Breaking news, Mitch is apparently dying from the plague, yeah. So he's probably not going to be saying much for the rest of the episode here. Unless you want to muster up the strength to say goodbye to your fellow people. I mean, we're not kicking you off or anything. You're just going to be coughing in the background. Okay.
Right. On the news.
Other news. So there's a few topics that we wanted to speak about. I'll let Brandon handle a few of these.
Yeah, all of these have speed solving links in the show notes if you'd like to see the threads that we're talking about. The first one is Sajwo, or Mikhail Jawuski, posted a thread. Eric Akersdyke is now ranked number 101 in 3x3 single. Now he's a little bit worse than that because that was back in October. But yeah, when this has particular significance to me because when I first started cubing, 708 was that was the world record at the time. And I looked literally today. The top 100 are 6.94 or faster.
Yeah, it's Rose time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah. How does that make you guys feel?
Well, I don't know about everyone else, but myself, it's. I mean, it's bound to happen as you have a lot of competitions. And people are getting better and more opportunities are given to them to really just show how good they are. I've learned not to ever think that it's over for times in cubing. Unless it's like that 6.80 single. That's over.
All right, Walk?
Yeah, I kind of feel bad. For Eric, just because to me that's also a very, very significant record. To me it's a much prettier number than 4.9, but I'll deal.
I think that part of it is just how the rankings work. When you're entering the rankings, you're actually competing with history.
Oh yeah.
And so it's very different from like rankings in sports where if a season ends, things kind of soft reset.
Yeah.
And so you're literally competing with everything that everyone is doing in the entire world. And so it's, like, much harder in cubing.
Yeah, and for all of history.
Yeah, for all of history also.
Yeah.
History is pretty fast, so.
Mitch, do you want to muster up the courage to say anything about this? Or not necessarily the courage, but, you know, the, fortitude.
Okay.
All right. I agree.
So.
I very much agree.
So when I started cubing back in, like, late 2009, when did Eric get the actual 708? Wasn't it, like,
July 2008.
Yeah, 2008. So the record had only been standing for about a year back then. And this was before Felix.
Mm-hmm.
An era before Felix, which not very many cubers today know about. And I remember watching that video, like, literally hundreds of times. And just, like, trying to figure out how amazingly good he was. And now I look at it and I'm like, that cube is a piece of trash. Cubing has come so far. Cubing has come so far in those past 6 years. And now to see that that's not even ranked top 100 in the world is insane.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I remember when I was... when us were starting out, Eric was at the pretty much at the top of a lot of, I'd say the most events, or at least a lot of events, like a significant number of events. Eric was world class, and I don't know. It just, of course, the times change, but I think he's still cubing. I actually don't know if he's still cubing.
Yeah, he posted like a 9 average.
He's still cubing.
5 official.
Okay, wow.
On YouTube recently.
A 9.
Yeah, a 9. He hasn't got very much faster.
Yeah.
In a couple years.
Or slower.
Or slower. Yeah, he's plateaued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he knows what he's doing.
Interesting.
All right. So our next topic is November 21st, 2015. This was the day that the world record 3x3 single of 4.90 was set by Lucas Enner, but it is also the day where Colin Burns had a 5.21 miss scramble, and Keaton Ellis had a 5.09, so three Americans in the same day at two different competitions, all beating the world record. Let's start by talking about the Colin Burns miss scramble. I assume we've all seen this, but maybe not as recently as we might have liked.
Oh, yeah. I believe that was the one where they found that it was an intentional miss-scramble, right?
Yes.
That is what I heard as well.
Okay.
Yeah, looking at the solution was literally 2-move double X-cross, 3-move insert for third pair, easy fourth pair, 8-move OLL, and then in PL it didn't really matter. It was an F-perm. But nobody does that anyway. That's an old meme.
I thought it was a G perm.
This says an F perm from the reconstruction that I see in this thread.
Oh. Yeah, I just checked. It's an F perm.
Yeah.
Just no one does it, so
yeah.
I didn't think it would be an F perm.
Yeah. So when this happened, Colin knew, like, from what I understand, Colin understood that scramble was a little bit too nice.
And yeah, I was there.
Oh, you were there. Okay.
Yeah, and he turned to me and he said, "That's definitely not a legitimate scramble."
Oh, like, boy.
He communicated very early on that, like, he felt very suspicious about how weird that was.
Yeah, I'm glad he had a video so they could have reconstructed that and found what was. In the original investigation, I think, I'm pretty sure, I don't know all the specifics, but I think, like, the scramble that he got has no traceable relation to the scramble he should have gotten. Is that
right?
Correct? Am I correct in saying that?
I don't recall that, but I guess that's what sets it apart from an innocent mistake.
Oh, and just the kind of damage control standpoint. It was kind of like how many before this?
Like how many times was there an intentional miss-scramble?
How many times could have this happened? Yeah. It's like, we don't know.
We don't know. Because we only scrutinize video footage and fast people.
Yeah. But, like, you never know, like, who else could have gotten said scramble from previous competitions and things of that sort. I like to approach this kind of stuff from kind of the damage control standpoint. What could have been done in hindsight to prevent it? But, like, there's really not much. Because there's always, like, people always need for competitions, people scrambling, people running and all that fun stuff, that the damage control is not going to be so good. There's always going to be eager people to try and help, and we'd welcome them. Do you think there could be something done to prevent something like this from happening again?
Yeah, I personally, I think we can definitely, for a lot of the competitions with bigger teams, can exclude unfamiliar people from scrambling and scrutinize scramblers, or at least have one person that checks the scramble along with a diagram of what the cube looks like. So you would have just one guy hovering around the table just looking at cubes. Like that could potentially
scramble checkers.
I mean, Mitch knows, like, we've organized competitions where Jeremy Fleischman, our local delegate, has said, we need to be using scramble checkers every time. Scramblers or scramble checkers need to sign off on the scorecard that they verified the scramble is correct. That way we know if there's any inconsistencies that we can find. Of course, actions can be taken or whatever the case may be. It'll be easier for people to be accountable for that kind of stuff. What are your feelings about expanding staff in that way, like qualifications for individuals, or if that should be in the regulations?
That's a really tough thing, because it's kind of, unless the person's very generous with their time, it's kind of hard to really just get people to do this. I feel like if we were to heighten the standards for performance of scramblers, we would need to compensate them in another way to make it worth, because otherwise they're just being scrutinized for no benefit besides helping out for a competition. So perhaps if they were, you know, paid, or if they had another form of benefit they would receive.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you make about, like, paying officials to officiate competitions. Or not officiate, but to like, just paying officials to operate competitions.
Right.
Do you think, well, this is a kind of question for everybody, but do you think that cubing is going to get big enough where we're going to need, it's going to be like a necessity for competitions to have a paid staff to operate competitions?
Okay, so I think it would only matter if there was prize money on the line. Yeah. If there was a very large amount of prize money and some person causes me to, I'm just saying me, you know, for example, I'm never going to get any sort of prize ever. But, you know, if I saw like what Colin saw in this intentionally misscrambled cube, and I got a time and I was under the impression that I would win prize money, and that ended up being retroactively deleted.
Yeah.
I would be very upset, and that would not sit well at all. And I think that if the stakes do increase, definitely there would be higher standards for performance and staff. And I guess Nationals is a reflection for this, because there is prize money, and the staff is composed of people who are very experienced and very honest.
And hand-selected by organizers and delegates.
And I think that's a much safer way to do things. And if other smaller comps, you know, become more prize money oriented, then I think it would invite, you know, a higher standard for officials.
Yeah, absolutely. So then that, I guess that covers the Miss Scramble. Let's talk about, on the same day, Keaton Ellis, just a little bit earlier, had gotten a 5.09 second solve, which at that time was the best in the world. Of course, he would later be beaten by Lucas Etter. Of course, Keaton's 5.09 is now second in the world. He never actually held any sort of record, as far as the WCA is concerned. But, I don't know, it's just interesting to me to think, should Keaton have, under like by the WCA, should he have been recognized as at least setting a world record, even for the short amount of time that he did?
Okay, I don't know. I feel like, well, first, I guess I can try to understand why they're not doing that.
Yeah.
Why aren't they? Like, what's the rule about that? Like, what's the
The rule is all records are tabulated at the end of the competition day, at the end of the calendar day. So if at the end of the calendar day there is some different solve or a different result or average or mean, what have you, that is better than the previous record, whether it be a continental record, a national record, or a world record, then the best person at that time is then recognized as the record holder.
Okay.
Wait, does this apply to just one competition, or does it apply?
No, it applies to worldwide.
Okay.
It gets weird with time zones.
Yeah, with time zones, it definitely gets weird. Of course, like there are there are still instances where you cannot verify what time, at least even down to the hour, that things may have happened, or down to the minute that things might have happened.
Mm-hmm. Because by that standard, like, yeah, you don't know when people are doing their solves when they finish their average in that specific time. So, like, let's take my SKU average thing, for example. Kenan got his average, like, at basically the same time I got mine, and, like, we still don't know when his actually happened. So I don't know for a fact whether or not my average happened before his.
Mm-hmm. And so it also gets even weirder when you say you get four solves that are so good that you're bound to get a world record, but you haven't finished your last solve, and whether to consider that a world record. But, yeah, it's really weird. I guess, personally, I feel like he should receive recognition, because I'm fairly positive that he broke it before Lucas.
Oh, he did. It was a previous round at the same competition.
Yeah, so there's, like, an 100% certainty that he did it before.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's less of a gray area. If they were in different time zones in different areas, and I couldn't say with 100% certainty, then perhaps I would have not recognized it.
Yeah.
But having a rule that, you know, that functions like that might be a little weird.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know, it doesn't sit well in my mind that Keaton doesn't get recognized on any level, except for, you know, state record, which is
Maryland is like its own little, like, it's insane.
Oh yeah, Maryland. I'll give you that. Like, Maryland is insane, but state record is not officially recognized by any stretch of the imagination. I don't know. I think that he should be recognized for at least breaking the record at one point, but having that distinction between being a world record holder and not being a world record holder, that line,
right?
I understand why the WCA has it now, but I don't know if I could design, or if the community could design, a system by which it would be, like, very easy to determine exactly as accurately as possible when particular records were set, and they were set for the duration of time, as far as we can estimate that those were actually held. So now let's move to Lucas Etter's world record 3x3 single of 4.90. This was indeed a full step solve. Had a few easy pairs at the end of F2L, but and a PLL skip at least an EPLL skip. But yeah, 4.90. If we had to predict the next record to be set, what do you think it would be?
That's a tough one.
I'm thinking something like not too much faster, maybe 4.75.
Okay. I would have guessed mid 4.
Mid 4.
4.41.
4.41.
4.41.
For those of you who don't know, 4.41 was a time achieved by a Mexican cuber by the name of Martin Telesforo, and it was undeniably fake. Or at least it was investigated, and then the board decided that it was fake and that was going to be DNF'd. I don't remember if there were any other ramifications, but that's the gist. So that's where that joke comes from.
I think he did get banned. Like,
ooh,
that was the ramification.
Okay,
tell us for
it. Mitch, what do you think the next world record might be?
4.7.
Okay.
By Felix.
Hmm.
Did you see that one video that Felix posted recently? And it was like, it was him and Kevin Hayes. They did a live stream like 2.5 years ago. And then somebody posted in the chat, like, who do you think is going to get the first four? And then Felix is like, Lucas.
Lucas Etter. Wow. It'll be Lucas Etter. And then it totally happened. Like, 2.5 years in advance. So the next piece on to wrap up the whole breaking records in 3x3 by three different Americans. Will Callen posted a thread on Speed Solving called What It's Like to Solve During a World Record for Keaton's 5.09. This is a video that Will took while he was solving, but as he was solving, Keaton got his world record, and there was this huge commotion and reaction, obviously, where he could have, of course, he could have gotten a. I think that if he really wanted to, he could have. He could have said, "Hey, can I get another attempt out of this?" Do you think that that reactions can reactions like that can warrant new attempts for stuff like that? Or if they do, do you think that reactions like that can get in the way of other people potentially setting records?
Okay, so that's a lot of issues in one.
Yeah.
Definitely, as it stands right now, I think excessive reactioning can certainly, or should, like, it's a very strong argument you can make that, you know, you can get another attempt. I was going to say, or just compare it to sports, for example, when players are doing their thing and a spectator or other players make, you know, make distractions. And that's part of the game, and part of competing is to adapt to your environment. But obviously, you're not expected to adapt to everything. So if something is like very, very distracting, then yeah, absolutely. I think perhaps better warnings could be given to people about doing this.
Yeah.
Because people seem to understand during blind that if you get a really good result, you don't jump out of your chair and start yelling. I've seen like a ton of people be, you know, they're very controlled about the situation. And so, yeah, I definitely think a lot of sometimes a warning may help where people say if they sign up for a competition, you can have them, you know, agree not to distract the other competitors. It's just hard to contain your excitement when something exciting happens at the same time.
Oh, absolutely.
It's kind of hard for reactions to be contained when, like, most of the people that are watching are, like, under the age of 12. Not to be mean in any way, but, like, that's kind of what it is. Like, the last competition that I was at in Southern California, a lot of the, like, the little kids that is their first competition and that kind of stuff, they weren't really watching the fast solvers in the front. They were more, like, being very loud in the back. And that's extremely distracting to the competitors in the front because we can hear them, and they're screaming and building cube towers and that kind of stuff. But that falls along the same lines of being pretty boisterous after a record or something like that, because other people are trying to do what they want to do, but you're being prohibited, and you like, in the case of what's this guy's name? Will?
I think it was. Yeah, Will.
Yeah, Will. So he had the opportunity of getting a good solve, but when your focus gets thrown off, it's completely bullshit. And, well, it
will bother.
Yeah, well, it's bad. And I had that one experience at World Championships 2013 where I would have had a sub-4 average of a mean of 3 on 7x7. Back then, that was pretty fast, and that would have put me, like, I don't know, like 7th or 8th or something. I couldn't remember. But then one of the competitors decided to throw their 7x7 at the ground, and it exploded, and it pelted me with a whole bunch of pieces, and I was really annoyed because I didn't know where the 7x7 pieces were coming from. I was completely distracted. Everybody was making noise around me, and I got completely thrown off during the middle of my edges. And if you know how solving 7x7 works, and during edges, that's the time where you're trying to focus the most, and I was completely thrown off. And that's not acceptable, I think, for cubing.
Oh no, absolutely not. That's a direct. I don't know. Reacting in that way, that's totally in control of in the competitor's control.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like,
yeah, in sports, that would be equipment abuse, and that's a violation in many, many sports. And
yeah.
So yeah, if someone did something intentional like that to frustrate other competitors, Yeah, that's a very easy case of, you know, perhaps not letting them compete for a while until they cool down.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it just boils down to bad sportsmanship. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's just difficult when kids are excited, because it is actually exciting.
Yeah. Waffle? Any...
Dude, I've just been so... I've come to terms that I will never be good at cubing, so it doesn't bother me anymore. So...
Okay. That's actually a very interesting subject, because a lot of people haven't come to terms with that, like you and me, you know? some people still, you know, they cube to beat themselves, and when that is frustrated by people congregating all around them, it's very upsetting for them, even if they, you know, don't think they're going to win the entire thing because there are three people that are sub 8 or whatever. You know, it still matters personally to a lot of people, and I think the rules should be considerate of that.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that it wasn't quite the congregation of other people that led to this, but I remember back when I was solving SCUBE regularly and competitively, I after setting a national record average, I had, it was like 5.10 seconds, and I knew that I could have gotten sub 5, and I had 9 other chances in competition to beat that average, and I never did. I choked every time, or the scrambles weren't good enough. I ended up getting 4th place at US Nationals. I got 2nd place at a local competition in Portland, where some other kid just happened to get have better solves than I did, and it put immense pressure on me, knowing, like, me trying to beat my own records, that I think just drove me away from the event entirely. It was too much for me to handle, I think. I think now I've come to terms with the idea that, you know, I'm gonna compete. I'm going to do events and be interested in them as they come, and try getting as good at them as I'll set like a goal for myself, and if don't want to be unrealistic with anything. But what's the approach that, since you both don't really mind about your times, what's the approach you take to cubing if you're trying to, like, do you ever try improving, or what's your school of thought?
For me, now it's just kind of maintaining where I am. It's no longer about improving beyond my current scope. It's just kind of maintaining, hey, this is where I'm going to be for the rest of my cubing career. So I might as well. I just want to make sure I don't embarrass myself at competitions by getting significantly lower times than what I'm usually going for.
Yeah.
Like, I love competing. I love going to competitions. I love speaking to other cubers. That's mainly why I go now. It's not really about the whole competitive atmosphere anymore.
Yeah, it's just going to see people again and chill out and have fun.
That's it.
Yeah, what about for you, Phil?
It's really interesting for me, because I had various periods in my career where I cared a lot, and it was really tough for me because I only did one event. And so if I did poorly in that, it kind of brings you down, and there's nothing I can do to compensate for that. Whereas, you know, if a person who's more well-rounded doesn't do well in one, they can rebound in another and boost their confidence and interest that way. But I really didn't have anything else to hold on to. And so the pressure was pretty taxing. And, cubing... Oh, by the way, thank God for mini cubes. Those were absolutely a lifesaver. But all seriousness, now it's gone from that to completely not caring, and then working for a cube company where I'm surrounded by cubes again. So no, it's like hard not to remove yourself from cubing a lot. And what's funny is I've recently done almost no one-handed whatsoever. Instead, I've been doing 3x3. And before the competition I went to yesterday, I practiced for about 2 solid weeks. And the first round I had yesterday, I set a new PB by a pretty sizable margin. So, you know, I'm pretty encouraged by that. And I think my goal right now is to learn and to develop as much as I can about my methods so I can show people in the future. Because a lot of the things I do in solves, they're really hard to explain in text, and so I'm hoping to organize them more and perhaps make more videos in the future about how ZZ works, because I think it has a lot of potential, and I see that in my practice. Now I get, like, random sevens and eights, and I've never gotten that before.
Oh, wow.
Except in 2x2.
Ha!
But, but I can notice myself getting better, and so it's really, it's like, it's a very interesting direction that I'm taking. I know that the likelihood of me becoming, you know, a top 10 or something is astronomically small, but I feel the likelihood of my material being used by a person who will eventually be there in the future is fair. So hopefully I can contribute to that.
Yeah. Yeah, because then we have you two who really... there have been times where you just really don't care about the competitive side of things. And then there's the polar opposite of that. Mitch, as somebody who's very well-rounded, what keeps you going?
New technology.
Okay. that's
the only thing, like, honestly.
That's super fair, yeah.
The Qi Square One that just came out a couple months ago, I was averaging like 21, 22 on Square One before that, and I don't know if you guys have all tried it. Well, I know Brandon's tried it.
Oh yeah, I love
Phil,
it.
Phil, you've obviously probably tried it.
Nope.
What?
Bro likes the Square One though.
Okay. Well, Waffle, have you tried it?
Haven't bought any cubes in like 2 years now.
Okay, well, I highly recommend the Square One. That's besides the point, though.
Me too. That was not an appropriate comment. But sorry, continue.
God. Oh man.
So the cubing technology, like, Edward Lin has said this before, but the only reason why he's progressed in cubing in the past, like, 3-4 years is just because of cubing technology. Like, back in 2011, the best 4x4 was basically the Maru, and now we have the Aosu, which is, like, miles better. Like, compared to the 3x3s back then, the Aosu feels like a 3x3 from then, so we're able to do a lot better and that kind of stuff. But the Qi Square One... I went from averaging like 21, 22 on that, and then when I first started doing solves with it, it was really weird and cumbersome because it's a new cube and you're not used to it at all. But then you get used to it, and it's amazing how your turning style, or at least my turning style, can adapt to cubes, new cubes, pretty easily. So the Qi, like, I was able to turn faster, basically, and my time's dropped like 6-7 seconds, and that's just from the cube, and I hadn't learned any algs in that time period. But now I'm trying to learn algs to get past that part where the technology brought me the drop in time. Now it's the algs will give me the drops in times.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I had a very similar experience with the Qi Square One. When I first got it, I just did an average of 12, and I was immediately 6 seconds better. Like, there was no... I didn't learn any algs. I went in cold, like, let's try this out. Factory tensions, the whole thing. And I found it was super easy to control, and I was averaging significantly better. And now that I hear that MoU is planning on releasing a Square One, I...
Wait, really?
Yes. The Halfcast will actually be covering more about things regarding... the MoU, what MoU's planning on doing with hardware, I think they're trying to look into that. Anyway, cube technology is, I agree, it's just gotten so much better, and I totally understand why that's the only reason why you keep going. For me, it's, yeah. I constantly tell people, I don't really care about competing as much as I care about making sure the competitions are successful, or trying to keep them as successful as possible.
Jesus.
That's all it is for me.
Back in my day, in order to be good at cubing, you actually had to be good at cubing. Jesus Christ. Oh, dude, I got a brand new cube. So much faster. Dropped in 2 seconds of my time. I can't believe that's actually how it happens now.
Yeah, as you've said, a good cube is nothing without a good cuber. Anyway.
But still.
All right, so I guess that'll wrap up the that'll wrap up the breaking the records in the 3x3.
So in other news,
yesterday, the 27th of February 2016, a special thing happened that is not related to cubing whatsoever. Pokemon turned 20 years old, or at least it was the 20th anniversary of Pokemon Red and Green coming out in Japan, which would later be Red and Blue everywhere else. One thing that a lot of people, I think, don't know about you, Phil, is that you are, or at least were, seriously invested into competitive Pokemon. First thing, what was it about competitive Pokemon that drew you in, or what was it, Pokemon in general? Could you just give us some background on that?
Well, I don't know. Like, I just like to do competitive things. And it could be knitting, or, you know, doing anything, really, that you can quantify your performance. I'm just drawn to the idea of, you know, competing in a thing where if you study and practice, you can interact with other people and, you know, have a fun and friendly competition where you win and you feel happy that your practice paid off, or you lose and you figure out what you did wrong. I think that generally attracts me. Pokemon was just a big thing. I grew up in a time where Pokemon was the thing, and they had to ban it from the schools because people were playing during class and big kids were beating little kids up for their Pokemon cards.
Oh my god.
And so, yeah, it was like a big deal, and so Pokemon was, it was pretty ingrained in, you know, social circles. When I was growing up, so I kind of just grew up with it. I grew up a Nintendo kid.
Yeah.
And competitive Pokemon's actually very interesting because most of the time you're playing against adults. The type of person that would, you know, play Pokemon, you know, isn't the same guy who would go to the store, buy a handheld game console and the cartridge. Usually, you know, it's like serious people who study the game.
Yeah. Okay.
And you're really pushing the limits of how a children's game works. And I think that's also, you know, relevant in cubing. We're really pushing the limits to how this puzzle can be solved.
Yeah. And similar puzzles.
And yeah, I played way too much Pokemon.
Yeah, I remember. We were both analysts. Well, you were really an analyst. I was just kind of I was kind of in for the ride for the Cuber Battle Association. What did you think of that in general? I'll link it in the show notes for people to watch.
Okay, yeah, it was it was not very publicized, so I don't think a lot of people would be familiar with it. I think it's a cool way for cubers to interact in a non-cubing environment, and sometimes it's fun to play random video games with your friends. You know, it's more fun than playing by yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly. So, yeah, that's a lot of fun, and to discover the hidden the secret skills of, like, your friends. Like, I never would have thought Kit was into Pokemon.
I'm always surprised, like, just how many people are know about Pokemon specifically, and who are mm-hmm. Who at least had a passion for Pokemon at some point. When I learned that you were very into competitive Pokemon, I was a little surprised, and then I thought, you know what, I'm not super surprised by this, but I was surprised at just how good you were and how much you knew. You know, just how comfortable you were with jumping in.
Oh yeah,
and doing that.
Yeah, I've been playing Pokemon for a very long time. But mostly through Generations 3 and 5. but there are certain game mechanics, and I guess the other part that's not game mechanics is anticipation, like trying to figure out what your opponent's going to do, and to make high percentage decisions, that never leaves you. And so, yeah, once you get used to doing that, you can kind of comment on that and talk about it anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like other, just like sports commentators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so that covers our entire news section. Next we have some closing notes, because we're gonna wrap this thing up, because we've been going for a long, long time. So, Waffle, go ahead and do your thing.
All right, so some closing notes. As we said before, we're going to be implementing something called a Halfcast. So keep your ears open for that. It's going to be great. Halfcast is basically a mini show. Let's just treat it like a mini CubeCast that happens halfway through our breaks in our episode. Guest announcement will be made very, very soon. Our next guest, we have plenty of people planned out, but this next guest is going to be awesome as well. And look out for some giveaways on our Facebook page. On top of that, what else do we have?
The only other thing I can think of is Skype Team Blind. I mean, I've been waiting for this forever. So I will post the scramble.
Are we actually doing this?
Would you like to do this?
I could. I won't be useful at all, but I'd like to do this.
The thing is, you'll be calling.
Will I? Oh no! Oh, that's not good.
Oh, I screwed up the scramble. I need to grab another cube.
Hey, no one told me about this.
What?
Okay, I scrambled, but I don't know if I did it correct, so I'm going to scramble another cube.
That's perfectly okay.
You got a pair up in you?
Yes, I do. Alright. So I'm going to go read. Alright, so for everybody at home, the scramble is U2, back 2, L2, F, U2, F2, L2, R2, U2, back prime, R2, down prime, L, F2, down, back prime, R prime, U prime, R prime, down, U. Yeah, and your cube should look like this. Wow, I just pulled this from
one
QQ timer.
Sexy scramble.
All right, so I'm going to get my timer going, or at least ready, and get on a blindfold. All right, so Phil, take it away. Give us a starting orientation, and as start as we making moves, I'll start the timer.
That's not cool. I'm like super scared.
Just play it safe.
Okay.
The
yes,
time
sir.
Doesn't actually matter.
All right, so you're gonna start with blue front and yellow top. All right.
Okay.
Okay, so when do we do this?
Go ahead, start calling some moves.
Okay, let's do an R. Okay, and then a U prime, and then an F. Okay, and then a B prime, an L, and then a B. And then do a U, an R, an L prime, a U two, an L prime, a U two. And let's do an L prime. All right, and then do an R prime, and then a U two, R prime, U two, and then L prime, and then U prime, R prime, U, R, U prime. Oh shoot. R2 U prime R U 2 R prime U R U R prime U R U prime R prime. Okay, and then do a U, and then R prime U prime R U prime R prime U two R, and then do a U, and this is an R perm, but I don't know which one it is. It's the one that starts R prime U two R U two.
Waffo doesn't know PLLs.
AUF?
R-U-2.
U-2.
And then, the AUF is a U.
Mine's good.
Yep.
Okay.
Arper. Oh,
what was the time on that?
Mine was 1:51.09.
It's not too bad.
Yeah, not too shabby. That was very safe, and I appreciate that you called every individual move until PLL.
Yeah, I was afraid to call the anti-soon. That's how scared I am.
Okay.
But you couldn't call our firm.
I don't even know the names of the cases.
It's alright, it's alright. Start off strong with my DNF for the season. Can't wait for another, like, 10 more in a row. Oh,
alright, so that was Skype Team Line. And so now some final words. This is a section that Waffo and I just... I don't know why. So my final words are, oh, I am slain. It is from almost every Shakespearean character that has died.
My final words is, what are you gonna do? Stab me?
I can't do mine.
Do it! Then will. Actually, it'll be your final words.
Bye!
Oh, man. Okay, so thank you so much, Phil, for being on the cast and for supporting us through this whole process.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Yeah, do you have any final words?
I mean, not as great as you guys, but yeah, thank you very much for having me, and we will be doing some pretty cool things with the cubicle in the future, especially with fixing our size, or our space issue, and once that happens, we'll be doing a lot more cool stuff, and hope to share a lot of the cool stuff in the very near future.
Yeah, well, we look forward to it. So, Waffle, want to wrap this thing up?
Absolutely, absolutely. So stay tuned for the next episode coming out, hopefully in 3 weeks from now. So, that's what we planned, right? 3 weeks?
Yeah, that's what we planned.
That's actually what we planned. We're going to have a nice rigid schedule. We're going to be releasing every 3 weeks, so hopefully we're not going to have any delay whatsoever. So stay tuned for that one, and until next time. Oh, no, that's right, Mitch can't do this thing.
Bye! Is that too? Okay.